Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this half-hour segment, we're going to continue with an analysis of some aspects of the area of intersection between the occult and the Third Reich that have echoed down to our present time. In our first half-hour segment, we began by taking a look at recent disclosures that an Austrian national who had tutored the Dalai Lama in a number of disciplines when the Dalai Lama was a young boy was in fact a veteran of the SS. This individual is being portrayed in a forthcoming movie in which Brad Pitt basically plays Mr. Harrer, H-A-R-R-E-R, the former SS man, and the tutor of the Dalai Lama, and Brad Pitt is the hero. He's the good guy. It's sort of unusual because it presents a former SS man as basically a good guy and a hero. We then took a look at the fact that seeing the SS operating in a context of things Tibetan should not come as too much of a surprise. The Onaner, by the ancestral research bureau of the SS, was heavily involved with various archaeological expeditions to parts of the world that they felt might reveal things about their, quote, Aryan heritage, unquote, and Tibet was one of those areas that they heavily studied, so that should not come as too much of a surprise. We then took a look at something called Colonia Dignidad. This is a German colony in Chile that has been the focus of a number of different controversial investigations over the years. Its leader, a fellow named Schaefer, has been charged with child molestation, and there appears to be some basis in fact for that. These charges have been appearing for quite some time. However, those charges, if true, are relatively mild compared to some of the other things that appear to have gone on at Colonia Dignidad. It appears to have been used as a torture center by the DINA, the brutal Chilean secret police. It may very well have served as a haven for various Nazi war criminals on the run, or not on the run, but I should say in exile, because they were hardly on the run, as some of our programs have shown. And elements of Colonia Dignidad have also intersected with elements of U.S. intelligence during the Cold War, because some of the Nazi and fascist elements present at Colonia Dignidad appear to have worked with elements of our intelligence system as anti-communist enforcers and occasionally assassins. We're going to continue in this half-hour segment with our discussion of Colonia Dignidad, something I've discussed in past broadcasts, including RFA 37 and RFA program number 21, among others. We are going to review some of the information about Colonia Dignidad that was touched on in those various programs. And for our information about Colonia Dignidad, or Dignity Colony, or Righteousness Colony, as it has been variously known, we're going to rely once again on a book entitled Unholy Alliance, subtitled A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult. That book was authored in soft cover by Peter Levenda, L-E-V-E-N-D-A, and was published in soft cover by Avon Books, copyright 1995. The ISBN number is 0-380-77722-3. And the author, Peter Levenda, actually traveled to Chile and visited Colonia Dignidad, and fortunately he escaped with his life. There are people who sometimes express their awe of what I do, and there certainly is a value to what I do, and it requires X amount of bravery, but I stick with printed information. I would no more go down to Colonia Dignidad than I'd grow a beak and feathers, and I'm in awe of people like Peter Levenda or Paul Manning, the journalist who wrote the definitive book about the Bormann Organization. That takes real courage. In Unholy Alliance by Peter Levenda describes the various activities that appear to have gone on in and around Colonia Dignidad as follows. Those who follow those stories of ritual child abuse we read about in the tabloids and hear about on such talk shows as Maury Povich, Oprah, Donahue, Geraldo, etc., know that the thread that runs through all of them involves a satanic cult in a remote area that kidnaps or breeds children for sexual abuse, torture, and human sacrifice. To those who scoff at these outrageous claims, we have only to point to Colonia Dignidad as a prime example of all the, quote, survivors, unquote, worst nightmares. Paul Schaefer was one of the founders of the Colony of Righteousness and was and is its only leader. Schaefer jumped bail in Germany in 1961 on charges of child sexual abuse, but that did not stop him from taking a group of families with him when he fled to Chile, arriving there in 1962 at the age of 40 with around 60, quote, blonde, blue-eyed settlers, unquote, including some children who were brought there under false pretenses, taken from their families back in Germany. His flock came from the town of Siegburg, S-I-E-G-B-U-R-G, across the Rhine from Bonn, where Schaefer claimed to be a psychologist and where he ran a youth home where the sexual abuse charges originated. Schaefer, also the leader of a Baptist sect, a sect which evidently condones sexual intercourse between adults and children, among other peculiarities, bought an old ranch called El Lavadero, about 250 miles south of Santiago in the Parral region, and quickly converted it into a self-sufficient, model community known as Colonia Dignidad, the Colony of Righteousness, or Dignity Colony. The population of the colony eventually grew to about 350, composed of 250 adults and 100 children. According to reports in the Chilean and German press, the sexes are rigorously separated and sexual intercourse is forbidden, except one gathers at the discretion of Schaefer. And since sex is prohibited, the only way the colony has been able to increase its population has been by, quote, importing, unquote, children from Germany. German authorities have been investigating charges that from 30 to 40 children reported missing from the Bonn and Cologne areas have wound up at the colony. Thus, charges of both child abuse and international child abduction have been leveled at this remote cult community by eyewitnesses, escapees, and responsible members of the West German and Chilean governments. The parallels between Colonia Dignidad and the stories perpetrated by, quote, satanic cult survivors, unquote, however, are even stronger. Spanish is not spoken. Instead, only German and, oddly, English are used. Old-fashioned 1940s-era clothing is worn, and 14-hour workdays are the norm. No television, radio, or newspapers are allowed in the colony. There is, however, a shortwave unit on the premises which is used to communicate with an office the colony maintains in Santiago, and which was probably the radio I heard being used during my visit. The colony established a free clinic on its premises, free, that is, on specific days of the week to members of the local population. They also have their own factory for processing meat, a 65-bed hospital, a bakery, dairy, flour mill, machine shop, power plant, and their own airfield. By 1985, they had even opened their own roadside restaurant on the Pan-American Highway. Accounts of the size of the colony vary from news report to news report. Everything from 12,000 acres to 37,000 acres has been offered, and accounts of its operations also include a mine, a lumber mill, and a gravel factory. The author believes it is safe to say that the colony has grown considerably over the years, and that estimates of a 37,000-acre settlement might not be far from the mark, considering the other purposes to which the colony was put both during and after the Allende regime. In 1963, a year after the colony first established itself in Chile, the Partido Nacional Socialista Obrero de Chile, the National Socialist Chilean Workers' Party, was formed under the leadership of Franz Pfeiffer. Taking more than its name from the National Socialist German Workers' Party, it became famous for its swastika banners, armbands, fascist salutes, and Heil Hitlers as it attracted approximately 10,000 members its first year. And Pfeiffer's was only one of many neo-Nazi organizations in Chile, including the lethal, swastika-brandishing Patria y Libertad, Fatherland and Liberty Party, founded by Pablo Rodriguez Grez, a member of Jorge Alessandri's unsuccessful 1970 presidential campaign, but it was the only one to host a Miss Nazi contest to which Nazi organizations throughout South America sent their dewy, swastika-eyed contestants. For those who like to keep track of such things, the winner in 1968 was the rather chubby brunette Señorita Porteña, obviously selected more for her value as a sturdy breeder of future stormtroopers than for any traditional chauvinistic petit bourgeois aesthetic considerations. It was in this climate that in 1966 the first of many accusations against Schaefer and the colony surfaced when Wolfgang Müller escaped the, quote, watchdogs, electronic alarms, and six-foot barbed wire fences, unquote, to describe life inside the colony. Müller, who had been brought over from Germany as a member of the original Siegburg group when he was 16, claimed that he had been forced into slave labor at the colony, was beaten, and had been sexually abused by Schaefer in Germany when he was 12 years old. One of Müller's more interesting claims, especially in light of later events, is his insistence that Schaefer had given him, quote, memory-altering drugs, unquote, when Müller attempted to rebel or to reveal the details of his abuse at Schaefer's hands. He also complained of electroshock treatments being administered by camp doctors, shades of Barbie at Marluk prison, and after his third escape, he wound up at the West German embassy in Santiago and now lives in that country under an assumed name, still afraid for his life. Müller also revealed the existence of several former Nazis who lived at the colony, but denied that Nazism was part of the colony's ideology. Later that same year, another escapee, Wilhelmina Lindemann, appeared with the same story of mind-altering drugs. This time, there was medical proof of her story. Doctors discovered evidence of injections on her body. The author has been unable to obtain Schaefer's war record, but it is clear that, born in 1922, he was of draft age when the war was in its early stages. As virtually every able-bodied man was eventually pressed into Hitler's total war, Schaefer must have spent at least a few years in uniform. But whose? The Wehrmacht's or the black and silver uniform of the SS? His open friendship with anti-democratic, pro-Nazi regimes and his hosting of several former Nazis indicates that he did not spend the war years in the camps as a persecuted Baptist minister. His self-professed background, however flimsy or fraudulent in psychology, his knowledge of mind-altering drugs and, as we shall see, of specific forms of torture, seem to indicate a somewhat more sinister education than Baptist Sunday school or Wehrmacht close-order drill. Indeed, when I, quote, met, unquote, Paul Schaefer in 1979, he was the epitome of the Hogan's Hero stereotype of the SS officer, although he wore a brown uniform with a Sam Brown belt and a campaign cap, an outfit that was more stormtrooper than Schutzstaffel. One imagines that the SA commander Ernst Röhm was more his idol than Heinrich Himmler, but who can say? The charges against Colonia Dignidad in the 60s came to nothing. Authorities tended to disbelieve Wolfgang Müller's more outrageous claims, and Wilhelmina Lindemann later recanted her story when the colony informed her that her husband had arrived from Germany and was living at the colony. She disappeared back into the sadistic embrace of Schaefer and his cohorts and was never heard from again. The Chilean Senate, to its credit, began an official investigation, but, quote, amid charges of bribery, the inquiry was dropped, unquote. Then came the election of Salvador Allende, and the colony took on a more active role in the political life of Chile and within the criminal milieu of the United States of America. The attempt to deprive Allende of his electoral victory began immediately after his election, and the telexes flew like curses between Santiago and Washington. The Chilean generals conferred day and night on the feasibility of staging a military coup that would prevent Allende from taking the oath of office, and this plan almost succeeded, except that incumbent President Eduardo Frei finally refused to support anti-democratic measures, a heroic move considering the amount of pressure being put on him by ITT, CIA, and the generals. While this is not the place to go into a deep discussion of the Allende regime and its aftermath, a little of the background is necessary to appreciate the extent to which Nazi organizations, and specifically the Nazi cult centered at Colonia Dignidad, maneuvered to overthrow yet another South American government. Eventually, Allende was sworn in as president, and the generals began a series of conspiracies aimed at destabilizing the new regime with the connivance of Chilean business interests, the U.S. ambassador to Chile, Edward Corey, and IT&T. It should be remembered that ITT had a history of supporting Nazi regimes. Walter Schellenberg, head of the foreign intelligence section of the SD, that, by the way, is the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS intelligence service, was named to ITT's German board of directors and remained on the board for the duration of the war and was paid a director's salary by the Home Office in New York. Funds were routed through to the Truckers Union, for example, to enable it to go on a protracted strike. Anyone who has been to Chile knows that the country needs the truckers to survive. It is one 2,000-mile-long highway from the desert in the north to the snowy wastes of the south. On December 2, 1971, after a year's worth of destabilization attempts by Chile's agricultural, industrial, and mining oligarchies, a tightly orchestrated demonstration of roughly 50,000 housewives marched on the presidential palace, La Moneda, to protest Allende's economic policies. It is worthwhile to mention that these 50,000 women were the wives, mothers, and mistresses of Santiago's wealthiest citizens, and that the march originated in the exclusive Providencia section of the city that the upper class calls its home. They marched on the palace carrying pots and pans, which they banged together, creating a cacophonous din, and were accompanied in their procession by members of Patria y Libertad acting as a kind of bodyguard. The empty pots demonstration, in which some women actually clashed with police, was carried on most major wire services, and scenes were shown on the nightly news in the United States with the implicit suggestion that these women represented the poor people of Chile who were starving due to Allende's mismanagement of the economy. It was an artful piece of disinformation, and it certainly worked to great effect outside of Chile. By the spring of 1973, however, rumors of an impending military coup were rampant in the capital. Among the conspirators creating discord both in the city and in the countryside was a young American, Michael Vernon Townley. Townley was a member of Patria y Libertad and an associate of other right-wing terror groups. A right-wing fanatic himself, who carried out assignments for a variety of masters, Townley also contributed to the development of the interrogation program at Colonia Dignidad. Working directly for and reporting to the generals, Townley was given the rank of major in the Chilean army, and together with Colonel Pedro Espinosa and the Chilean secret police, DINA, liaised with Patria y Libertad to create a climate of terror in the country conducive to a military coup. Patria y Libertad had already planned one coup attempt earlier in the Allende regime and were ripe for another. When the time finally came in September of 1973, with the military invasion of Santiago, the bombing of La Moneda, and the assassination of Allende, the roving, Freikorps-like bands of Patria y Libertad and the Chilean Nazi Party were cleaning up the streets and rounding up the usual suspects, intellectuals, students, artists, communists, outspoken opponents of the army, and outspoken defenders of the president. Most of these young prisoners were taken to the National Stadium, including two young American men who were subsequently murdered. Many were tortured and then executed. Many others were simply disappeared, their bodies found later, sometimes years later, in shallow graves and in roadside ditches. A few others, the most unfortunate of all, found themselves at the colony. One of Townley's tasks in the immediate aftermath of the coup was to establish a state-of-the-art black art detention center at Colonia Dignidad. The following story would seem fantastic were it not supported by eyewitness accounts, statements of DINA defectors, and later United Nations, U.S., German, and Chilean government and Amnesty International reports. If we were to believe Paul Schaefer, Colonia Dignidad is nothing more than a Christian religious commune organized around somewhat Calvinist lines of hard work and prayer. If we were to believe virtually everyone else, Colonia Dignidad is an after-hours club on a side street in hell. Colony leaders had already established firm ties with the military long before the coup. According to Farrago, that's Ladislas Farrago, by the way, the author of the book Aftermath, it was a favorite hangout of Chilean Air Force officers and, of course, Martin Bormann and Josef Mengele. Schaefer cultivated government connections through both his Santiago-based office and his colony, where he also maintained a radio link with various DINA secret police operatives abroad in Colombia, Venezuela, and Europe. Inquiries into the colony's operations were effectively hushed with the strategic placement of bribes all the way up to the Senate, and somehow, the colony had bribes to spare. According to the soldiers I spoke with that night in Parral, the mail arrives virtually every day with envelopes full of money for the colony. As it turns out, some of this money comes from pensions being paid to colony residents from the formerly West German government, one of the reasons all the colony residents are German citizens. But the soldiers I spoke with insisted the money came in from all over the world, including the United States. Its source can only be a cause for speculation and concern. With the coup, however, the colony got a chance to put its electroshock and narcotics therapies to the test. Townley and DINA agents had the run of the colony both at Parral and at the colony office in Santiago. While DINA maintained contact with its agents all over the world through the colony's radio link, Townley helped design the specifically equipped interrogation cells. These were tiny, soundproof rooms built underground where political prisoners were taken not only for actual interrogation of a political or military nature, but also for the purpose of developing new methods of torture. At first, each prisoner was questioned closely to obtain sufficient information concerning his or her personality in order to develop an appropriate torture and interrogation scheme. This individualized approach is already well known to the intelligence professionals the author has come into contact with over the years. The ostensible goal is to enable the interrogator to so finely tune the torture procedure that the victim surrenders his or her will more completely, more expeditiously. In practice, however, and with such a, quote, scientifically, unquote, adjusted scheme of programmed sadism, there is tremendous room for an interrogator who is so inclined to subject the victim to unimaginable suffering over a long and sustained period of time. That this is what, in fact, took place at the colony is beyond doubt, for certainly there was nothing scientific about the dogs, and then it quotes from a report. In Colonia Dignidad, prisoners have allegedly been subjected to different, quote, experiments, unquote, without any interrogation. To dogs trained to commit sexual aggressions and destroy sexual organs of both sexes. And then Lavenda goes on to comment, I have used the exact words of the United Nations report of October 1976 to avoid being charged with unnecessarily embellishing my account with sensationalistic hype. According to the same UN report, the detainees' heads are covered with leather hoods which are stuck to their faces with substances that are supposedly chemicals. In these underground cells, interrogations are carried out through electronic equipment, including loudspeakers and microphones, while detainees are tied naked to metal frames to receive electric shocks. That's unquote. And then Lavenda proceeds to comment. When the colony was finally visited in 1987 by a group that included Chilean, West German, and Amnesty International officials, the underground rooms where prisoners had been held and tortured were discovered and identified. What has been described, therefore, is a scene that not even the Nazi death camp commandants were able to invent. Torture and interrogation by remote control. Individual prisoners in hermetically sealed, soundproofed cells underground, tied to metal frames, being asked questions by invisible interrogators over a loudspeaker, and being jolted with electricity through a remote control panel when slow in answering. And the man who helped design this infamy was the electronics expert and radio freak, the American Michael Townley. Townley would probably have remained unknown to most Americans had it not been for the assassination of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffat in downtown Washington, D.C. Letelier had been Allende's ambassador to the United States and his minister of defense in the last days of the president's administration, and had been one of the first to be arrested once the generals took over. Letelier had then been transferred, first to the prison ship Esmeralda and then to Dawson's Island, a frozen wasteland at the far south of Chile, where he was tortured and starved for months before pressure from the world's governments forced General Pinochet, who had named himself dictator for life of the country, to release him and send him into exile. Letelier was not one to turn his back on his country. He waged what can only be called a tireless global campaign to destroy Pinochet's government by peaceful means. He spoke eloquently before trade unions, longshoremen's unions, and whoever else would listen, urging them not to cooperate with the Chilean regime. The result was the refusal of these unions to unload Chilean vessels, to transport Chilean goods, and a general consciousness raising among world governments concerning the severe human rights abuses that were taking place under the openly pro-Nazi Pinochet and his Nazi-trained secret police, the DINA. When Pinochet ordered Letelier killed, and through his henchman, Colonel Contreras of DINA, selected Michael Townley to carry out the assassination. By the way, in the L.A. Times article carrying the San Francisco Chronicle that we read in our first half-hour section, Contreras' son is commenting favorably on the colony. Continuing. Townley had already met Pinochet in the company of Stefano Della Chiai, the Italian terrorist and compadre of Nazi conspirators Klaus Barbie, Freddy Schwend, and others. Della Chiai had brought his friend, Prince Valerio Borghese, with him. The prince had been the main organizer of that aborted coup against the Italian government and was a member of Licio Gelli's Masonic P2 Society. Between them, they were able to provide professional advice, logistical support, and commandos sufficient to carry out the program of hunting down all of Pinochet's enemies, including, but not limited to, Orlando Letelier. By the way, Stefano Della Chiai was the individual who helped to craft the strategy of tension under Operation Stay Behind and Operation Gladio that we've spoken about in numerous programs. Continuing. By August of 1975, Townley was in Europe on an assignment from DINA to murder Carlos Altamirano, a Chilean socialist leader. Della Chiai had intervened, saying that Altamirano was too difficult a target, and recommended another enemy of the Chilean junta, Bernardo Leighton. Receiving the green light from Santiago, Townley arranged for the hit to be carried out. Leighton survived the attack, however, even though he had been seriously wounded. Pinochet, Townley, and Della Chiai would meet again, this time in Madrid, where Pinochet was attending the funeral of colleague and fellow traveler Generalissimo Francisco Franco, the fascist dictator of Spain since the days of the Spanish Civil War. Then, in 1976, Townley, with the aid of a group of the ubiquitous anti-Castro Cubans, set the bomb which blew up the car carrying Orlando Letelier and his assistant, Ronnie Moffat. The car exploded by radio remote control just outside the Chilean embassy in Washington, D.C., in full view of Letelier's mortal enemies. Eventually, Townley would be apprehended and would plea bargain his sentence by giving details of his escapades to the U.S. government and turning in the Cubans who helped him carry out the assassination. The resulting revelations enabled the U.S. government to issue an arrest warrant for Townley's longtime boss, Colonel Manuel Contreras of DINA, a warrant that predictably was never honored by the Chilean government. This century has seen its Waco, its Jonestown. It has survived limping its Auschwitz, its Cambodia. It stares with a kind of numb horror at its Bosnia and Somalia. But there may yet be another conflagration awaiting its last years in Colonia Dignidad. Shortly after Letelier's murder, a DINA informant, Juan René Muñoz Alarcón, a former member of the Socialist Party, made a deposition to a human rights group in Santiago run by the Catholic Church. In that taped statement, he identified Colonia Dignidad as one of the sites where the, quote, disappeared, unquote, had been sent in the years following the Pinochet coup. Juan Muñoz was stabbed to death shortly after making his deposition. That same year, 1977, reports were published concerning testimony by one Samuel Fuenzalida, a former DINA agent, who admitted transporting political prisoners to Colonia Dignidad in 1974 and turning them over to the personal custody of Lagercommandant Schaefer. In 1984, George Packmore and his wife Lottie managed to escape the colony. Tragically, their adopted son was left behind. They confirmed reports of beatings, drug injections, and other brainwashing techniques by Schaefer and his medical staff to the West German government. According to reports published in the Washington Post on Christmas Day of 1987, the West German government at that time was sending anywhere from $48,000 to $80,000 in pensions to colony members each month. That same year, an American citizen mysteriously disappeared while hiking near the colony. Boris Weisfeiler was an American who was born in Moscow. Although his body was never found, the Chilean government officially concluded that the hiker had drowned in a river near the colony. In 1988, the Packmores appeared before a Bonn government subcommittee and gave detailed testimony about the conditions at the colony. They testified that young boys were being given injections in their testicles and that Schaefer was observed by them viciously beating a young girl bloody. Testimony from another witness, Hugo Barr, a co-founder of the colony who escaped in 1984, referred to the famous Mercedes-Benz limousine, the one that blocked my escape in June of 1979. According to Barr, the limo was bulletproof and heavily armed. Occasionally, Schaefer is known to loan it to his good friend, General Pinochet. Then the author goes on to describe the apparent occult religious practices that took place at this Nazi colony. The only other evidence the author has to offer is what he was told by soldiers of the Chilean army the night before his visit to the colony. They have their own religion, they assured me. They celebrate festivals that are not on the Christian calendar. Accepting for a moment that Chile is largely a Catholic country and that the practices of a traditional German Baptist might seem strange or unusual to a soldier of rural background and upbringing, the celebration of holidays, quote, not on the Christian calendar, unquote, gives one pause. Christmas, after all, is still December 25th, whether or not one is a Catholic or a Baptist. The only possible deviation from the date for a Christian would be Russian Christmas, celebrated by members of the Russian Orthodox Church, who still employ the Julian calendar. Skipping down, the soldiers went on to reveal that these celebrations took place at night and involved candlelit processions and chanting. At times, great bonfires were burned. This could either be harmless religious processions, such as the author himself was a participant in as a child, or something a bit more sinister. With the colony's activities over the last 30 years being relentlessly revealed in all their revolting glory, one must assume that its religious practices were more in keeping with the pagan cult activities of the Third Reich than with the holy day festivities of Saints Peter and Paul Catholic Church of Commercial Avenue, South Chicago. Although the author did what he could to get out of candlelight processions as a boy, he was never able to concoct a story about injections in the testicles or demonic dogs. And that's all we have time for in our discussion of the colony and some of the occult influences on the Third Reich. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.